From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the tenets of the Beatnik religion. We'll meet comedian Marc Maron. He's currently off-Broadway performing his comic monologue, The Jerusalem Syndrome, which was described in the New York Times as the spiritual journey of a radical materialist. Also, gossip columnist Liz Smith talks about reporting on the personal lives of celebrities while trying to keep her private life private. She's written a new memoir. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. With world oil prices at their highest level in 10 years, the presidential candidates are sparring over solutions. We have two reports, the first from NPR's Madeline Brand, who outlines the proposals of Democrat Al Gore.
First, crackdown on big oil companies, Gore says, are reaping windfalls at the expense of consumers. Second, make OPEC live up to its agreement to produce more oil. And third,
I support oil releases from our National Strategic Petroleum Reserve. We ought to start with several releases of 5 million barrels each.
Gore says that would increase supply and thereby lower prices. But some oil analysts say Gore's proposal is too modest to drive prices down. Americans consume some 18 million barrels of oil a day. President Clinton says he'll wait to take any action on the reserve until the oil market has had a chance to react to OPEC's promise that it will produce an additional 800 million barrels a day. Madeline Brand, NPR News, Hollywood, Maryland.
I'm Peter Kenyon with the Bush campaign. The Texas governor wasted no time in attacking Gore's energy proposal as a political ploy designed to disguise the fact that the Clinton-Gore administration has no coherent national energy policy. Speaking to high-tech workers in Cleveland, Bush said Americans are angry over high gas prices and the prospect of higher heating oil prices, and he said Gore's plan to tap the strategic reserve is short-sighted.
The strategic reserve is an insurance policy meant for a sudden disruption of our energy supply or for war. Strategic reserve should not be used as an attempt to drive down oil prices right before an election.
Bush has proposed an aggressive domestic oil exploration policy, including the development of sensitive sites such as the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska. Peter Kenyon with the Bush campaign in Cleveland.
Government scientists are reporting an increase in drug-resistant gonorrhea. NPR's John Hamilton has more.
During the 1980s, doctors in the U.S. grew accustomed to seeing patients with gonorrhea that wasn't easily treated with the most common antibiotics, penicillin and tetracycline. The bacteria had developed a resistance to those drugs. So doctors switched to newer drugs, especially a group called fluoroquinolones. But on Thursday, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported early signs that even those drugs are losing their effectiveness. A study in Hawaii found that last year about 10% of gonorrhea patients carried a strain that's resistant to fluoroquinolones. That's up from about 1.5% just 2 years earlier. A second study identified a dozen men in Kansas City, Missouri, with gonorrhea resistant to the drug azithromycin. Public health experts say the study suggests it will take a steady supply of new drugs to control gonorrhea in the future. John Hamilton, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow Industrials gained 77 points today to close at 10,765. This is NPR News. The president of the World Bank says it's a crime that development aid has fallen. Speaking ahead of the joint annual meeting of the bank and the International Monetary Fund in Prague, James Wolfensohn challenged the world's rich economies to alleviate the misery of the poor. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Prague.
The World Bank's mission is to combat poverty. Bank President James Wolfensohn suggested never has the cause seemed more appropriate or urgent. While the industrialized world has enjoyed sizzling expansion, the disparity between the rich economies and poor ones is ballooning. The World Bank says the income of the top 20 countries is 37 times the income of the bottom 20. The bank chief says there's a risk of social unrest and that it's in the self-interest of rich countries to alleviate global poverty. He called on Western governments governments to open their markets to more imports from poorer countries, but Wolfensohn rejected a campaign to cancel all the loans owed to the bank, saying it would deplete resources for new ones. The bank had said if someone would like to sign a check for $70 billion, he'd be happy to forgive all the debt. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Prague.
Campaign officials for U.S. Senate candidates Hillary Rodham Clinton and Rick Lazio are trying to reach an agreement that would eliminate the use of so-called soft money in their race for the Senate from New York. Lazio, a Republican congressman, brought up the issue last week during a televised debate in which he walked over to the First Lady's side of the stage and urged her to sign a contract he said would ban soft money. Clinton said she wouldn't sign unless conservative groups agreed to stop spending soft money to help Lazio. Lazio said he has now obtained that agreement. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Mark Maron is a comic who does what some people describe as alternative comedy. He used to host Short Attention Span Theater on Comedy Central. He's now off-Broadway doing his comic monologue, The Jerusalem Syndrome. The show is about the search for some kind of transcendent meaning. The review in The New Yorker said, Maron is fully aware of all the dubious idols that have replaced God in our culture, and he pulls no punches in pointing them out. He leads the audience into purgatory and back as he tries to find some kind of spiritual resonance in Hollywood fame, cigarettes, The Wiz, Coke, and Israel. He may not be the Messiah, but he's definitely the guy to tell you where you won't find him. Maron's monologue begins with the story of being invited by a friend to go to Israel. He accepts and buys a camcorder to take with him. I asked him why he wanted the camcorder.
I don't know. You know, I never owned one. I've always been sort of against the whole idea. I'm sort of even against taking pictures because I think they're false representations of good times. For some reason, I felt that it was necessary for me to take the camcorder in order to have some sort of religious interaction. I just thought, just in case, you know, I was addressed by the Almighty, that I should certainly have the camcorder and be ready to tape any interaction.
Did the Almighty converse with you?
No, he broke my camcorder. There was a lesson to be learned, you know. It took me, you know, months to figure it out that, you know, I had, you know, surrendered my will to this, you know, 1.5 by 2 inch viewfinder. You know, I was walking through an illusion I could hold in my hand. And, you know, there were, unfortunately, the moments where it wasn't working. I was so consumed with getting it fixed that I had a hard time enjoying the entire process of being in Israel. And oddly enough, I felt very frightened when the camcorder broke because I was directly, you know, in contact with the Israeli sort of situation. I really think I was planning on taking it all in at home on my VCR in Queens, in my building where, you know, Muslims, Jews, and Christians all live happily under one roof, you know, unless there's a boiler problem. You know, then we rise up against the Dominican landlord. But aside from that, it's a lot more manageable than, you know, really not knowing, you know, where you are in the context of the culture over there, because there are so many towns that are now sort of, you know, up for grabs as far as Palestinian territories and whatnot. And I really am not educated in the dynamics of the Middle East that much. I come from, you know, sort of sofa Zionists, you know, my parents, you know, we were not that educated in it, and I don't keep up with it. You know, my parents were just people that sat at home and watched the news, and occasionally someone would say, oh, no, there's something wrong in Israel. Get the checkbook. Where do we write it? You know, that was that.
Although you're not religious in terms of Judaism, you do feel like you have been part of the Beatnik religion. What are the tenets of that faith, the way you've seen it practiced?
Well, it's a spiritual system. There are sacred texts. You have On the Road by Jack Kerouac for the ritual elements of the religion. You have Naked Lunch by William Burroughs for the morality and metaphysical elements of the religion. And you have Howl by Allen Ginsberg for the gay poetry elements of the religion. And I believe that all religions have a gay poetry element. I defy you to read the Song of Solomon in the Old Testament with a slight lilt in your voice, and you will find there most certainly must be a gay man behind that poem. It just wasn't popular to be an out gay poet during the Bible writing. Now, the tenets are actually, it's a spiritual system built on searching, embracing life, pushing the limits, you know, being awake and wasted to be aware, being beat, questioning everything, freeing your mind, the path of excess leads to the palace of wisdom, man. Nothing is true. Everything is permitted. To be beat is to be holy, and to be holy is to be closer to God. When Kerouac was on a late-night talk show, he once said that all he wanted was to look God in the face. And then he threw up on himself during a commercial. That, and there are rituals. Do you want to hear about those?
Yeah, Terry? Yeah.
Well, once you assemble your bohemian crew, which is, you know, essentially 10 to 12 disenfranchised upper-middle-class white kids whose parents can afford to spend $40,000 for them to spend 4 years sinking their beatniks in college, the rituals are, you know, there must be beer and cigarettes and coffee. You must read good poetry and write bad poetry and read that out loud. You must, smoke reefer and listen to jazz and stay up all night. And there's also room within the beatnik religion to call and ask your parents for money if you need it.
So did you make pilgrimages?
Oh, absolutely. Of course, you know, any car ride with another person, pot, music, and no real destination is officially a beatnik pilgrimage. But, you know, some are more important than others. I made pilgrimages, sure. My buddy Jim and I used to, I think the most important pilgrimage was the pilgrimage to Jack Kerouac's grave. You know, we went up there, you know, it's a beautiful fall day. And, you know, you want to hear the poem?
Sure. And who wrote this poem?
This is a piece from the show, you know, where, you know, we climb behind the helm of a 1979 Honda 5-speed, a foreign car, a heresy, not really beat, but it was my dad's and it was free. The mellow hum of Japanese machinery propelled us towards our destiny. Boston to Lowell, all 45 miles, and we didn't fall asleep once. We talked about art, philosophy, politics, and what to have for lunch. We jammed to jazz and beat our hands on the dash, and I think we made it through half of Coltrane's Love Supreme when we pulled onto the path to the angelic Holy Hipster Cemetery and the Tomb of St. Jack.
That's good. Now, you wrote this for the show?
Yeah. the odd thing is that I actually found myself, you know, at that point in my life, after I did visit the grave of Kerouac, I wrote some sort of poem, you know, of course. And I wasn't able to find it, and I think I'm thankful about that. I'd rather this sort of parody poem than, you know, the sort of earnest doodlings of a guy who was just in love with the beatnik idea.
You know, you've described yourself in the past as a paranoid agnostic. Mm. You said, I doubt the existence of God, but I'm sure there is some force somewhere working against me.
Yes. Well, that was, I was younger when I wrote that. And as I get older, I'm trying to meet him halfway and hopefully, you know, not make enemies forever. You know, you got to pick which God you want to work for.
Have you ever really envied people who did have faith?
I envy their ability not to be consumed with the sort of, you know, indulgent worries of somebody who has no faith at all. I think I've always been somebody who has had faith. You know, I think that it's never been deeply rooted. You know, you have faith when you need it. When things are going good, it's easy to go, man, you know, everything's working out and I believe. But as soon as things get bad, I was never one of those people that, you know, automatically. I was always the opposite. I felt that, you know, my faith was paying off when things were going well for me. But when they were going bad, I was just, you know, angry at the world and everybody around me. So that's not real faith. So I think that, you know, I resent or I envy people with real faith only because they seem to have, you know, some sort of focus. You know, it may not be healthy, but they do have some sort of focus. And it's usually restrictive, which I find annoying. But I think there's something about belief, whether it's in God or yourself or you know, a particular product or, you know, there's something about the idea of belief as a human propelling force that I find interesting.
My guest is Mark Maron, and he's doing his comic monologue at the Westbeth Theater in New York through the 30th of September. Now, some male comics do a lot of, like, sex jokes, and a lot of it is pretty adolescent and kind of sexist, too. Did you ever go through that period yourself in your comedy?
I do. I am a strong proponent, is that the word? Supporter?
Yeah.
Of sexual material. I like blue material. I like I like people to go there. You know, I don't know. I never went through a necessarily sexist period. I have spoken openly and honestly and sometimes graphically about sex. But I think that's a very important part of stand-up in the way I see it. I think it's always been one of the few hot spots with people. I don't think people are ever above, or can condescend to sexuality. And I think that, on some level, it is sort of can be kind of nasty. And I have no problem with that. I think it's great. I think it's a vulnerable place, and it's a taboo place. And I think some of the best comedy comes from those places.
I'm wondering if there's some of the material you can do for us just to show us what you mean that would be, clean enough for radio. What do you think?
Well, the joke that I did about, getting older, I'm 36 years old, which isn't old, but you realize you're getting old in strange ways. Like, I realized recently that teenage girls don't even acknowledge me as a sexual being anymore, And I mean, I don't want you to misunderstand me. I'm not saying I want to have sex with teenage girls. I'm just saying, hey, throw me a bone. How about a smile? Cute T-shirt. Look at me. Nothing. Unless it's to turn to their friends to go, why is that weird guy looking at us? What's he doing at the mall? I'm lying, Terry. Of course I want to have sex with teenage girls. I mean, doesn't everybody? I mean, that's why there's a law.
Is that part of the joke to say that?
Yes.
Right. Okay.
That is the joke.
That is the joke. Okay. I wasn't sure that was a personal aside to me or, okay.
That is fairly lightweight. I find that my attitudes towards sex in my act, I've always had problems with people who, not people, but the criticism that stand-up is cheapened by sex, it's cheapened by blue material. Uh-huh. I just don't believe it. I believe that that's what stand-up should be about. I believe that, as a stand-up, it is, you should go there. Because that's why people come. That's what makes it exciting. That's what makes it, that's what pushes it to the edge. And I understand that, a lot of times it is approached adolescently, and a lot of times it is sexist, But on another level, these are also the voices. These are the inner voices of human sexuality that, you can choose what you like and what you don't like. But I think it's, I think it's important. I think it's an important dialogue to have. Within stand-up. I think it's one of the reasons that stand-up can be exciting. And all of my favorite comics have attacked it.
Did you grow up being uncomfortable talking about sex?
No, my parents were, very sexually inappropriate people. They were very crass. They were very, my father has always sort of had a robust, sexual, appetite, both verbally and otherwise. I was not in any sort of repressive environment. As a child. So it was always, around as far as conversations go and as far as jokes go.
My guest is comic Mark Maron. He's performing off-Broadway, doing his comic monologue, Jerusalem Syndrome. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is comic Mark Maron. He's currently doing his comic monologue, The Jerusalem Syndrome, at an off-Broadway theater. Were there moments during your early work as a comic that you found kind of humiliating, either because of the place you were playing or the reaction you got from the crowd or the fact that there wasn't a crowd?
Of course. Of course. It's still humiliating sometimes. What are you kidding? I mean, that never goes away. I was recently tackled on stage in Los Angeles, by an audience member.
Why?
Because I pushed his buttons. I like to push buttons.
What were you talking about?
What was I talking about? I was doing a joke about that used suicide in it, which isn't funny by itself, but, surrounded by other things can be hysterical. The joke had nothing to do with mocking suicide. It was about whatever the case, you know, maybe I'll tell you the joke afterwards here. But, you know, some guy in the front row said, you know, don't do jokes about suicide. And, you know, I said, well, I don't really think this joke is about suicide. I think it just, you know, that's just part of the joke. It's not making fun of suicide. But he said, just don't do any more jokes about suicide or I'll take you out. And, you know, then it really became something different, you know. And, you know, I said, you know, what is your problem? Why do you need this attention from these people you don't know? What's going on with you? You know, what is, you know, and I really just started to sort of, you know, fire my way into his psyche. And I really made a fool out of him, you know, for interrupting my show and threatening me physically. And people were laughing. People were on my side. And then I very sort of, you know, arrogantly, you know, propped up after I succeeded in pummeling him comedically and said, are you still going to take me out? You know, and he got up on stage and he tackled me, and you know it was really awkward. We stood each other off. You know, I'm really by nature, I'm not a fighter. You know, you have two options as an animal: fight or flight. I come from a long line of flyers, and you know, and we were standing off, and there was a music stand between us. You know, and I didn't know if he was going to pick it up and hit me with it, and I really didn't know what to do. But because I was on stage, I ended up just sort of you know hugging him. I just sort of jumped up on him and grabbed him. So I, you know, and he grabbed me and we went down and, you know, the audience dispersed and four people kind of, you know, wrenched him off of me and they're holding him down, you know, and I'm standing on a chair, you know, with the microphone still and the audience is, you know, everything's in chaos. And this guy is like, you know, wrenching back and forth in the hands of these, you know, four men going, who's funny now? You know?
So, how did that evening end? Did they throw him out and then you went on with the act?
Well, I was the last performer and I'd done about 20 minutes, so it actually turned out to be an excellent closing number.
Yeah.
What happened was, you know, I'd like to say that, you know, I sort of made my stand and took the hit for, you know, comedy, but you know what ultimately happened was, you know, they threw him out. And what made this evening all the stranger was, you know, Vincent D'Onofrio was there.
The actor, uh-huh.
Yeah, so, you know, I still to this day have a weird, strange thing with, you know, boundaries in Hollywood. Like, I get there, and I'm never really quite sure whether I'm in a movie or whatever's really happening is happening. And then when stars show up, I'm like, oh, my God, where's, you know, we're in a movie. But what happened was they kicked him out, and, you know, people were coming up to me. They were like, you know, you probably should hang out for a while. Don't go outside or whatever. And, you know, I'm like, you know, I was really sort of shooken up. My shirt was sort of ripped open and whatnot. And, you know, but I felt proud of the whole thing. I've really been waiting for years to be, you know, attacked on stage, given the nature of what I do up there sometimes, you know. And, but eventually I had to leave the club, you know. So I walked out and a lot of people were out there, you know, in the street, and they're all sort of talking about it. And I walk out, and you know, and D'Onofrio was there, and he was like, "Are you okay, man? Do you gonna, you know, do you need, you know?" And well, what happened was, the guy came back around with his friend in a car and pulled up out in front of the club when I was standing out in front there, and everybody was around, you know, and gets out of the car, and you know, I'm being sort of held back by, you know, Vincent D'Onofrio, and he's like, you know, offering his assistance somehow. And a lot of people are offering their assistance and they're like, you know, just go back inside, Mark. And I'm like, you know what? Let's deal with this. So this guy's walking towards me and I'm like, what is it? What is it that you want? Do you want to hit me? What do you need right now? You know, and everybody was sort of sitting there and he's like, I just want to, you know, I got to talk to you. And I'm like, okay. So I put my arm around the guy and I walked down the street with him by myself. And he said, look, you know, I'm sorry. I'm not like that. You know, I just, you know, my brother, you know, recently committed suicide and, you know, and I'm like, well, okay, I understand that, but I still feel that, you know, your behavior was inappropriate. He's like, yeah, I know, but, you know, you understand, right? I'm like, yeah, I understand. And, you know, it's cool, you know, and I'm sorry about your brother. And, you know, we hugged and, you know, he moved on into the night and I moved on into my life. That's all.
I would like to hear what the joke was that upset him so much.
I'm trying to think, how's that joke set up? Wait. Yeah, like I was watching ESPN2, and I don't even like sports, and I'm watching, you know, the second one. And all I have to say is that there is a shortage of sports worth covering on television, because I was watching a miniature golf championship. You know, and I didn't know who to feel bad for, you know, me watching a miniature golf championship or the guy who's got to be the commentator, you know, because he wanted bigger things, you know, baseball, hockey, real golf, you know. And he was there and he was trying to make it interesting. You know, he was like, well, he's at the most difficult hole. That's the windmill, of course. You know? Look at him out there like Don Quixote. Gee, what's a guy like that got to be thinking in a moment like this? Let me take a crack at it. Blade, space. Blade, space. There's the shot. Oh, it hits the blade, and that's going to hurt him after the bogey at the dinosaur. You know, I think if he would have went with the red-handled putter and the blue ball, it would have been a different day from out there. I think it was that red-red combination that really screwed him up, don't you? And then I get sort of dirty. I go, instill in the voice, I go, did I mention I'm going to kill myself? Did I mention that? I mean, I'm covering miniature golf. I'm going to go back home to the house I grew up in, into my little room where my posters and my model airplanes are, and blow my brains all over a poster of the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders. Does anyone care? Well, we have a website here at ESPN2. You know, that's basically the joke.
Right.
It's got nothing to do with suicide. It's a, you know, sort of a sad portrait of a bitter man. But somehow or another, occasionally you don't know how people are going to respond and what your power is as a performer. And I, again, a lot of times I create a sort of intimacy that doesn't allow much distance.
But you know, I'm thinking here, it's partly the difference too between someone like you who's really verbal and who does everything through words, and someone who just like really doesn't know how to express themselves except through, say, you made me really angry, so now I have to fight you. Now I have to hurt you.
Yeah. Yeah, that was sort of what happened. But, you know, I believe me, Terry, I mean, I've been doing this for years.
Right, and this doesn't always happen, yeah.
I've been hostile. I've been provocative in a confrontational way. You know, I've really pushed my luck on stage in more ways than I can even remember. And it hasn't happened. And now at this point in my life where I've sort of leveled off and I don't need to do that. You know, when you're younger, you really think you're angry about certain causes. And then as you get older and you realize that you might just be angry, you know, you have to make choices around that. So, you know, I mean, now at this point in my life where I've leveled off and I think I have a certain amount of being, I'm grounded up there, that this starts to happen is very interesting.
Well, Mark Maron, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Mark Maron is performing his comic monologue, Jerusalem Syndrome, off-Broadway through the end of the month. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From Saab, featuring an all-turbocharged lineup, with safety features like the Saab Active Head Restraint System, SaabUSA.com. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of Sabbath, Finding Rest, Renewal, and Delight in Our Busy Lives by Wayne Muller, now in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, gossip columnist Liz Smith talks about reporting on the personal lives of celebrities while trying to keep secret a central part of her private life. She's written a new memoir called Natural Blonde. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Liz Smith is one of America's most famous gossip columnists. Before we meet her, let's hear a clip from what is probably the best movie about the business, the 1957 film The Sweet Smell of Success. Burt Lancaster plays a ruthless gossip columnist. Tony Curtis is a press agent who'll do anything to get his clients into the column. In this scene, the columnist and the press agent are talking at a restaurant when they're interrupted by a senator.
May I ask you a naive question, Mr. Falco? Exactly how does a press agent work?
Well, answer the man, Sidney. He's trying to take you off the hook.
You just saw a good example of it, Senator. A press agent eats a columnist's dirt and is expected to call it manna. But don't you help columnists by furnishing them with items?
Sure. A columnist can't do without us, except our good and great friend J.J. forgets to mention that. You see, we furnish him with items.
What, some cheap, gruesome gags?
You print them, don't you?
Yes, with your clients' names attached. That's the only reason the poor slobs pay you, to see their names in my column all over the world. Now I make it out you're doing me a favor?
I didn't say
the day I can't get along without a press agent's handouts, I'll close up shop and move to Alaska lock, stock, and barrel.
Liz Smith says that when she got started in the 50s, gossip was a cynical business, kind of like it was represented in the film. One of her early jobs was working for a theater press agent, trying to get items into columns by Walter Winchell and Dorothy Kilgallen. Then Smith ghost-wrote Igor Cassini's society column, Charlie Knickerbocker. She started writing a daily column under her own name in 1976 at the New York Daily News. Her syndicated column is now carried in over 70 papers. Liz Smith has written a memoir called Natural Blonde. I asked about her ethics when she's publishing personal news. She told me it all depends on the source.
When Nora Ephron told me she was divorcing Carl Bernstein, I didn't feel I had to check that out with anybody. But ordinarily, I might call a lawyer, say, is this just a rumor? Or is it really in process? Is it actually going to happen? Might try to call the parties involved or call one of them, depending on what the other one said. You know, you want to give them both a chance to say their piece.
If a person is involved with something or has a problem that they really don't want to make public, and you know that they don't want to make it public, but you've found out about it, how much does their desire to not have it be public count for you? Or is that irrelevant because if you can prove that it's true, you can just print it?
Well, I never wanted to write the nastiest gossip column in America, and I always held back from writing things that were intensely hurtful, though some people don't think I did. But, you know, I don't generally write items about situations where people are obviously ill, where they need drug treatment or they need alcohol, need to go to AA, or they might be good if they checked in at the Betty Ford Clinic. I would sort of hold back on that unless it became a matter of public behavior that was so outrageous that there was no point. Just like I wouldn't be the one to write about an extramarital affair, because I just think that's too dangerous and hurtful. It's too hurtful. I don't want the wife or the husband to read about it in my column. I'd rather just pass the item up.
Now, Nora Ephron once gave you the story that she and Carl Bernstein were divorcing. Then Bernstein called you and said it wasn't true, and he begged you not to print it. But you did print it. Tell me what went through your mind in deciding whether to go with it or not.
Well, I felt I had the facts from her. She intended to divorce him, and she wanted it printed. And so I didn't pay much attention to his desire not to print it. I printed that they would divorce, and he was furious with me forever after. I mean, someone's desire that you not print news is not totally germane to the process of getting correct news out. And I felt Nora was a pretty good source as to whether or not she was going to divorce Carl. They had been, you know, written about quite a lot. I mean, he was having an open affair with someone, and it had been in the paper, not by me. And so I knew she was serious. This was quite a piece of news to those who cared about them.
Why do you think she wanted it in your column? How would it have helped her?
I feel she wanted to not have to answer any more questions, and she wanted it to be definite, and she wanted to put him on notice how serious she was. I don't know that I thought about that at the time, but now I think that's what it was. I think she used my column to make it permanent, to make him see she was serious, because I guess he was arguing with her that she should forgive him and forget it. They should go on being married together.
Now, you met Carl Bernstein at a party after that, and he told you that you'd ruined his life. In what way did he think you'd ruined his life?
Well, I didn't pay attention to his protest, and I guess he felt I was responsible in some way for his happiness. I mean, I thought that was ridiculous.
Did anyone ever talk you out of writing something? Did anyone ever call you and say, please don't go with that?
Oh, my God.
It's really
going
to hurt me. Yeah. What are those conversations like?
Well, I try to talk them into it. And in fact, a part of my work, I feel, is trying to talk people into agreeing with me that it would be better for me to cover the story than to have it appear in Page Six or the National Enquirer. And sometimes this works. If I say, you know, this is all around town and everybody knows it, it's going to be printed anyway, so why don't you think about a way that I might be able to print it first and get it all out of the way? And this is a good argument to some of them, to some people.
What do you tell them the advantage would be if you printed it as opposed to, say, a tabloid?
Well, I would have their cooperation in telling me the facts from their point of view. And I might be sympathetic or I might not, but I mean, I wouldn't be out to try to drive them into the ground like a nail, and they know that.
Now, you became friends with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton when they were married, and they were, I mean, among the most prized subjects of gossip of the time. After you became friends, was it difficult to figure out what was printable and what was private?
No, they gave me really free rein and access to them, and I followed them around, and I would stay with them in places in Europe and observe them for, like, while they were making movies, or one of them was making one. And so I don't recall their ever asking me not to print anything. They weren't that way, but they were performing for me. You know, they were doing their married thing.
Well, what a strange position to be in, that people are performing their marriage for you as opposed to actually living
their marriage. Well, I think
they were very
taken with their love affair and the fact that they had married against public opinion and that they'd been beleaguered by the paparazzi all over the world and despised and denounced by the Vatican. So they wouldn't have stood still for publicity without thinking it would, you know, be to their benefit. And I always thought they put on a great show for me when I was around, and I got some fabulous stories about them. I wrote about them in Rome, in Paris, in London, in Moscow.
What was one of your favorite stories about them?
My favorite story about them is a story about them eating. They were great gourmands, and they constantly were talking about what they wanted to eat or what they would eat if it wouldn't make them fat or what they had eaten in the past. And I wrote a whole article on this, and I think it's terribly funny and very revealing of them.
My guest is Liz Smith. She's written a new memoir called Natural Blonde. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Liz Smith is my guest, and she has a new memoir called Natural Blonde. One of your biggest scoops, you say, is a story that you say put you on the map, was shortly after you got your own column in the New York Daily News. And this was, I think, in 1976. Kitty Kelly had leaked you information from the forthcoming Woodward and Bernstein book, The Final Days, their book about the last days of the Nixon administration. Now, a couple of a newspaper and a magazine had paid a lot of money to excerpt this book before publication, and you got some of the tidbits in it for free before they got a chance to excerpt the book. Why did Kelly leak it to you? How did she get it, and why did she leak it to you?
She was one of Carl Bernstein's authentic truthsayers. A lot of people do like to tell you what's going on and what they know. It's amazing. But they're not press agents anymore. They're just ordinary people who like to gossip.
Well, she's a professional gossip. I mean, she's written very gossipy memoirs about celebrities.
Well, that's true. But, I mean, she was in no position to do anything with this
right.
very fragile, briefly newsy information, which was going to be published any second in The Washington Post and in Newsweek. So she decided she'd give it to me. And I got a big scoop. It went around the world. It made me famous. We described Nixon and Kissinger praying on their knees. And, oh, it was an incredible story. The paper called me, the Daily News telephoned me and said, you don't know what you've given us. This is so great. So it was a big scoop, and it infuriated Newsweek and infuriated the Washington Post, and I don't blame them.
Did you owe Kitty Kelly big time after that?
Well, she already owed me big time, so I thought we were even.
What did she owe you for?
I had given her all of my files on Jacqueline Kennedy.
And oh, from her book on Jackie. Uh-huh.
Yes, and I had always tried to help her, and I had helped her, or would. I'm the sequence of events here might be a little wrong, but I did help her a lot later on her book on Frank Sinatra.
Is that part of how the game is played? People owe each other favors, and they pay back with information?
No, I think, again, it's more the truth-saying impulse. I mean, if I knew something and somebody was writing a book, I would offer to help them if I liked them, thought they were a reputable writer. When I gave Kitty my files, I didn't know what kind of writer she was. I just thought she was a very amusing and funny and dishy girl.
In your book, you write about how you helped Rock Hudson cover up something that he was being blackmailed about. Was he being blackmailed by somebody who was trying to out him?
Well, I assume that's what it was. I said the other evening on 60 Minutes that when he called me, he told me this woman was going to print a story about his homosexuality. But in retrospect, I'm not sure that that's exactly what happened. I'm beginning to try to remember that we may have just had the conversation without any mention of what she was trying to reveal, because it really wasn't necessary. He knew that I understood.
What could you do to help him?
Well, I didn't know what I could do. I was appalled. I hate blackmail, and I knew that this kind of story would really effectively ruin his career as a romantic leading man. Those were very different times than now, though not totally different. And I said I'd call him back. So later I thought a little bit about this lady who was going to reveal the story. And I looked through my files and I found, lo and behold, I found a file on her. She wasn't a star or a public person, but she was someone that I had known slightly, and I had some information on her that wasn't too savory that I would never have printed. So I sent the file to him, and I said, I suggest you show this to her. And he did, and she dropped her plan to go to the tabloids. So he had a few more decades of peace, I guess. The poor guy, he finally died in a most horrible way.
You knew Rock Hudson was gay, right?
I didn't know it for many years. I met him early in the 50s, and I knew him a long time before I heard that he was gay or thought that he was. He never acted in any way to make me think he was. And in fact, I was around him a lot on a movie location in Rome, where he was making For Whom the Bell Tolls. And I didn't know then that he was gay. I had a big crush on him.
When you did find out that he was gay, did you consider printing it or...
Oh, no, of course not. Why would I help him stop somebody else from printing it if I would have printed it?
No, why would that qualify as something that you wouldn't print, whereas, say, somebody's divorce is something that you would print? Like,
well, people live over divorces, but people used to absolutely hardly live over being revealed as gay. I still don't write that people are gay unless they are self-avowed and openly gay. Mm-hmm. I think outing people is a very cruel thing. And I don't write about the children of celebrities either, though I get a lot of news about a lot of them. But I never wrote about John and Caroline Kennedy. I just didn't think they didn't ask for their notoriety. So they're just things I try to stay away from.
Now, a question a lot of people expected you to address in your memoir is whether you're a straight, gay, or bisexual. Time magazine has a review, you've probably seen it, where the headline is, Liz Outs Self, Sorta. And it says, if you can call this coming out, it is one of the weirder coming outs in the history of the genre.
Well, it's okay with me. I mean, it's okay with me that they think that. I have spent a lifetime of conflicting experiences, and I try to tell that in the book. And I just am not going to categorize myself, so it's okay if other people want to categorize me. I don't care what they say, but I'm not going to do it myself. I might change my mind tomorrow. I have changed my mind many times.
Well, you do write about a brief romance when you were in college with a woman student who was engaged, and the relationship ended after your parents read your love letters. You refer to this in your book as your ill-fated affair with the, quote, wrong sex, which is, I guess, what your parents called it?
That's right. Boy, at the time, that was really a fact. I'm writing that in the context of the time.
Mm-hmm.
It was certainly considered the wrong sex. And it certainly made them unhappy and made me unhappy. I had a very unhappy experience. So I try to tell about that to sort of illustrate the conflicts that young people go through when they think they're madly in love and can't live without somebody and the person doesn't seem suitable.
Then the next relationship you had was with a man, the way you describe it in the book.
Well, I had already been married when this other incident happened. I'm just not settled in this. I'm not going to nail myself in the box. It's okay if somebody else wants to.
No, you know, what a lot of people are trying to figure out, too, reading your book, is whether the 15 years that you lived with a close companion who was a woman was an intimate relationship or not. Now, I'm not asking you to answer that question. Wait, I'm going to ask you my question. My question is it any of our business? As someone who's a gossip columnist, is it any of our business what the nature of that relationship was?
It's okay if people want to make it their business, but I think I was pretty straightforward about that. I think if you read my book, you don't have to read so much between the lines. You can figure it out for yourself.
Oh, so the answer is then?
Well, I had a very intense companionship with this wonderful person who's still a very good friend of mine. I guess the answer is yes, but I mean, I think you'd know that from reading the book.
My guest is syndicated gossip columnist Liz Smith. She's written a new memoir called Natural Blonde. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our conversation with gossip columnist Liz Smith. When we left off, we were talking about how she's tried to keep private the fact that she had a 15-year relationship with another woman. Now, did anyone ever try to blackmail you during your years, you know, just to say that you had or that you were having a relationship with another woman? And did you worry about that possibility? You'd seen it happen to other people.
Yes, I worried about it mainly because it would reflect on another person who wasn't a public person. And this is something I guess all people in the public eye worry about their significant others if they're, you know, embroiled in anything controversial or so forth. It makes you worry about the private person you're involved with. Yes, I was constantly being attacked by the underground gay press and by people sending anonymous letters and things, but I managed to live through it.
Attacked by the gay press for not coming out?
For not coming out. They wanted me to be a role model for a gay life, and I wasn't always leading a gay life. I wasn't ready to be their role model, and I'm still not.
Did anyone threaten you in such a way that it could have, ruined your career? Did anyone threaten?
I don't think it could have ruined my career. I was very popular. For the first 7 years I wrote my column, I couldn't do anything wrong. And then I made a joke and said, for the next 7 years, I couldn't do anything right. Now, my column has always been very popular. I've been in demand. I've worked for 9 newspapers in New York City.
I guess here's what I'm wondering. What was it like, or what has it been like, to be in the position where you're always interested in reporting on celebrities' private lives, but you have or had something in your private life that you really wanted to keep from the public, and it's the kind of thing that the public would have been real interested in hearing about?
Well, I can't account for the public's taste. It's like the reaction to this book. As soon as you even say the word sex, you don't have to say bisexual, you don't have to say gay, as soon as you say the word sex, everybody thinks I've written a book about sex. And I think it's the least part of my book. As for your question, I just went my way and continued working, and an awful lot of people swirled around me who seemed to want to, you know, do something to damage me, but I think that's perfectly normal, and I don't really object anymore to people responding against gossip columnists any way they please.
But again, just in terms of what it was like to have something you really wanted to keep private, something really central to your life.
Well, I wanted to keep private because it would be hurtful to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think I would be fired or anything. I wasn't, no matter what people wrote and did.
So you were more worried about your partner than you were about yourself.
Right. And other people, my parents and my brothers, my nieces, my nephews. I had a wonderful family. I didn't want to embarrass them.
But again, I'm wondering if that was an odd burden to be carrying around while you were in the business of writing about other people's lives and private lives.
Well, let's don't kid ourselves. Every person who has any kind of deviant sexuality in their life, or sexuality described as deviant, is carrying a burden. I don't think they're, you know, even openly gay people are still beaten to death, and bad things happen to them sometimes. This country has an extremely puritanical streak, and it still has it. It's very Victorian in certain ways.
I guess let me put this more bluntly. Did you ever feel like it was hypocritical of you to know that there was something in your life that you really had to protect, while at the same time you were trying to make public things from other people's lives that they might have wanted to protect?
Well, maybe it was hypocritical, but I don't think hypocrisy is anything new in any stratification of society. So I just did the best I could, and I always tried to be fair to whatever I was writing. I tried very hard to be fair, to give people a chance to answer, to tell two sides of things. if it seemed to me there was one, and to not complain too much about what people said about me.
How long do you think you will want to keep your column?
Well, as long as it seems viable and it works and people like it and there's a demand for it and the papers keep renewing my contract and I'm healthy and able to work, I'm knock wood in very good health, and I'll go on, to, I guess, till I drop in my tracks or they throw me out.
Now, in your book, you call gossip the tawdry jewel in the crown of free speech. Gossip is often used as an almost dirty word. It's just gossip. What do you like about gossip?
What do you like about it? Don't you like it? Or are you too pure to like it? You know, I mean, I think that gossip is absolutely endemic and, I mean, substantive in human nature. I think we're all constantly talking about each other and about what we think we know or heard or saw, overheard. And we use this sort of medium of exchange between us to enhance the human condition. It helps us figure out what we think. It helps us sort out our ideas morally. Did we approve when we're gossiping? Are we approving or are we disapproving? Or are we trying to figure out what we think? And I think that a lot of gossip is just this idea of let me tell you a story.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Liz Smith has written a new memoir called Natural Blonde. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Sherrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from museumshop.com, an online boutique of products from museums around the world, including the Louvre in Paris and the British Museum in London, museumshop.com, and from Princeton University Press, publishers of The Expanded Quotable Einstein, available in bookstores or online at www.pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, Isabella Rossellini. Her new film, Left Luggage, opens this weekend. Also, a review of the re-release of The Exorcist and a talk with Mercedes McCambridge, who did the voice of the demon. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.